History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. What we've learned over the years is that they don't have to go untold, as long as you and I are willing to take a little initiative and ask a few questions, and then invest enough time to patiently listen as long-buried memories come to life again. Our goal is, first and foremost, to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we really are inspired by these men and women who have put their lives on the line for the rest of us. I know we checked all of those boxes last time with John D. Hosey of Woodinville, Washington, a decorated veteran of both the Korean War and the Vietnam War, but there was so much of his unique story left to tell that we made an exception to the rule and decided to carry his story over to another episode. So that is what we have in store for this hour today. And if you missed the first part of his story, how he lied about his age and enlisted in the Army at 16, becoming a paratrooper in the Korean War, where he received the first of three Purple Hearts, also how he met his wife of 66 years, Sandy, you can access all of that in the podcast version of that episode at hometownheroesradio.com. Today, we're going to get to hear about the mission that earned him the Silver Star and left him with his second Purple Heart. And of course, we're going to hear about the third as well. When we left off last time, he was explaining how one of the celebrities he transported as a helicopter pilot in Vietnam was the actress and entertainer Martha Ray, quite well known for her support of the troops during that era.
There was one time I flew her into a hot zone. She put on a smock and helped the corpsman take care of the wounded as they came in. When I picked her up and took her back to Bamituit, we were having dinner that night, and she says, "John, you know what I didn't like about today?" And I said, "Maggie, from what I hear, you have nothing not to like or to be ashamed of what you did today." She says, "When I went back and finished my show, I forgot to take off that bloody damn smock." And I laughed at her. And I said, "Maggie, don't worry about that." Because she had told me to call her Maggie, because I was start out calling her Colonel Ray. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Captain, do you want to be my friend?" And I said, "If I'm going to be your pilot, yes, I'd like to be your friend." She said, "Then my name is Maggie." Mm-hmm. So from that point on, I called her Maggie. And she told me, she says, "I don't know how you do it, John." I said, "Do what?" She says, "You fly in and out of all this. You pick up all these wounded and dead and everything. You have your helicopter shot up with holes. How do you do that? And you don't drink. You don't smoke. You don't even drink coffee." I said, "Well, Maggie, at one time I did drink. But I found out that I didn't need it. Let me ask you a question, Maggie. The way I fly you and the places I fly you, would you rather for me to be flying you with a hangover or with a clear head?" And she says, looking at it that way, "A clear head." So I said, "Well, that's another reason that I don't drink." When she came home, she called Sandy, invited Sandy up to her home and everything. And because Sandy was staying in El Cajon, California, while I was in Vietnam.
She called Sandy to tell her what a great guy you were, or what?
Yes, not only that, and that she called her and told her that she had just, well, the funny part was, when she called and got Sandy on the phone, she says, "This is Maggie." Sandy says, "Maggie? I don't know any Maggie." She says, "Martha Ray, the big mouth." And she said, oh my. And Sandy was pregnant with our last daughter at the time. She says, "Now don't drop the bread out of the wagon or out of the basket." And so they talked for a while, and then she told Sandy that she had just left me and that I was okay and doing fine, not to worry about me, that she had spent a lot of time with me, and that I was fine with a pretty level head and everything, and that she was almost positive that she would see me again. And she says, and when he gets back, I want you to come up to Hollywood here to see us. So Sandy wrote me and told me about Martha Raye calling her and everything, and it made my day when they did that.
It sure seems. As I hear you talk about Martha Raye, and maybe it's because right behind you there's a medal on the wall that's got her face on it, and that was presented to you. But I hear a lot of respect in your voice as you talk about her and her commitment to you guys, the troops.
Oh, yes. I would give her an A+ as far as her respect for the troops and for her commitment to the troops. I flew her into Special Forces camps where other entertainers wouldn't even dare go. I know that Bob Hope, he was over there a lot, always in a secure area. He came to Da Nang, but he was in a very secure area at Da Nang. So he was really in no harm, in my opinion, anytime he came over there. But every time Martha Raye came over, she was in nothing but harm's way. And that medal and all that you see there on the wall, she told her husband she wanted me to have that. The one there on the right is a ring, an airborne ring, and there's only two of those. One of them she gave to John McCain, and he put it in a museum in Arizona. That one she gave to me, and you can see where it's at. The other one is her airborne pin, and she gave that to me. This other one is a Patrick Henry medal that she was given, and it was presented to me. She's got a plaque up there that says to Lieutenant Colonel Hosey from Martha Raye. I put it in that shadow box because I thought an awful lot of her. I was at her home, I think, 3 times. When she died, I was invited to come down and speak at her wake, and I met a whole lot of movie stars. One of my favorite was Gene Barry. I met him, but I flew Tallman, the attorney against Ironside, Robert Stack, and also Wendell Corey. I had the honor of flying June Playmate of 65. She was quite cute.
Did she call Sandy when she came back too?
No. She didn't. But I also enjoyed flying the cheerleaders. I flew them 2 flights into places for them to do what we called handshaking tours, you know. But the biggest thing was, and I'll talk more on it later if you want me to, but I was supposed to go and pick up Robert Mitchum, one of my favorite movie stars. And that's the time that I volunteered to go in and pick up some wounded and get them out of a hot zone, and I got all shot up.
Well, and I'm thinking about what you described as that conversation between Martha Raye and your pregnant wife at home when she tells her, Maggie tells her, I'm pretty sure he's going to be back home safe. Boy, when we hear the story of this mission and what you did and the decorations you received for it and the state your aircraft was in when you got back, I think that's going to raise our eyebrows a little bit. So you were supposed to go pick up Mitchum, and you passed on that to volunteer to rescue some wounded. Am I getting that right?
Yeah. I heard over the radio that this outfit was in trouble. It was what we call a MACV unit. They were in trouble and being shot up pretty bad and needed some evac real fast. One evac had gone in and got shot up, and one observer aircraft had gone in, and he had taken fire. So I called my 6, and I said, I would like to fly over, take a look, see what's going on, and let you know if I want to take an attempt of going in. And he said, okay, you've been in country long enough, and you know what you're doing. He says, use your own judgment. Well, in a way, that gave me an open field. So I listened to everything that was going on the radio, and whenever I got to the hot zone, I saw what was going on. They were surrounded, and they had about, maybe 100-yard field of fire for them, and the enemy was pretty close all around them, and found out it was not only the North Vietnamese, but Chinese regulars also. That was firing on them. Most of the firing that I was concerned with was coming from what I called the 2 o'clock position once I hit the ground. Well, I listened to what was going on. I contacted the ground people and I said, how many wounded you got? And the captain that was in charge says, almost everybody but me. And I said, okay, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to act like I'm leaving, but when I get overhead, I'm going to chop the power, make one circle, and that one circle, I'm going to be on the ground. So you be ready to put your wounded in and get them in as fast as you can, because my door gunner is going to be protecting everything while we're on the ground. Well, I contacted the Air Force that was giving close air support for them, and I told them what I was going to do. And I said, if you'll keep most of your fire off to the southeast of us right there, into the tea trees, if you'll keep most of your firing in to that area, I'll land to the east and I'll take off to the east. And I got a roger on that. So I told my crew, I said, watch for fire. Any place you see fire coming at us, you fire back. I said, once you start taking fire, don't stop. I made my circle and started to the ground, and all firing stopped. I thought, but I hit the ground. I was on the ground about 5 seconds, and all hell broke loose. We started taking fire, and I know you, like me, you've never been inside of a popcorn machine, but that's what it sounded like. As the bullets came in and out through the chopper, it sounded like I was in a popcorn machine. Pop, 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 pop. They started loading up the wounded and everything. And when they hollered, go, my co-pilot says, I'm hit. And according to what my six said, right behind him came me too. And he said, I've never heard the calmness that I heard, John, in your voice. He says, it was just me too. And he says, I thought, uh-oh, I've lost a crew. But then he said, the next thing I heard you was airborne. But in between that, I tried to pick up my chopper, and I gave it too much power, I pulled too much collective in. I heard, rum, rum, and I looked around, and all of my instruments had been shot out. So now I'm going to fly by the seat of my pants. So what I did is I set the chopper back down. I raised it up. You've seen a chopper. The skids are curled on the front, on the end of it. Well, that's so that you can do a run and takeoff. I picked it up on those skids, and whenever I picked it up on the skids, I started down between tea trees. My gunners were both firing, and they were picking up leaves on the end of their machine gun from the trees. And as I got a little bit of speed, I popped the chopper up, and then leveled off again and tried to start to climb. And my co-pilot, I looked over and he was bleeding, and I hollered at my crew chief to get up there and put a tourniquet around his legs. I had been hit in the right calf, and there was one bullet that my camera was hanging on the instrument panel. And that camera took a bullet that was meant for my right knee. And if it had hit that right knee, it would have shattered it. Now, whether we would have got out, maybe I could have left my foot on the pedal and we could have still got out. But I didn't have to find that out, because that camera took that round. And you remember the old wind-up cameras? You know, the winder is the heaviest part of the camera. That bullet hit that wind-up. And I could have killed my kid. He took it to show and tell, and somebody stole it from him. So I don't have the camera to show you.
But you have a story, and I just want to underscore the importance of that. So if that camera is not in that exact spot, if it doesn't hit right in that winder, it's not just you that might not be here. It's everybody on that helicopter.
Somewhere around about 12 or 13 of us thereabouts would not be here. Anyway, I took us into a field hospital and landed. I had medics all around my chopper after I shut it down, and they opened my door and they said, understand you're hit too, sir. And I said, don't worry about me. Take care of the wounded in the back, because some of them were chest wounds and everything, and I was just hurting. I wasn't in, you know, I was not hurt bad. So they pulled my pilot out, got him in, Jimmy Johnson, who lives in, he lived in Clinton, Washington here. Jimmy was really a good pilot. He was back with me in about 3 months after being shot through both legs. He went right through here, and the bullet hit the seat and was in the seat with him, and I kept the bullet. But he was back in the unit in about 3 months. I was only supposed to be off duty for a few days, but I wound up flying. And the worst part of me, when they got the bullet out of my leg, they did not really clean the wound really good. And the second night, I was asleep, and all at once, my leg burst open. My bed got messed up with pus from the wound, and I went to my doctor there. He asked me, who cleaned that wound? And I said, the field hospital. And he says, well, if they cleaned it, they should have put in a drain. In other words, they should have cleaned the wound and then put a drain in, because this drain should be pulled out about every 2 days and cut off and checked, and that would not have happened. And that was the worst pain that I had been in, including the shooting. The shooting was nothing except like a hot poker hit my leg. So he took care of that. And there was one Vietnamese general over there that anywhere he flew, he wanted me as his pilot. I don't know why, because he took a liking to me. But every time he had asked me if we could go somewheres or get somewheres, I'd read his map and see where, and I'd look at him and say, ha, no problem, sir. And that's all he ever got out of me was, no problem, sir. So the day I was actually wounded, he wanted to go from where we were at there at the field hospital back to Pleiku. And he came up to me and he says, are you ready to go? I said, I can't fly, sir. I'm grounded. He says, what? I'm not going either then. But he says, I need to get back. And I said, well, I'll tell you what. I'll let the other pilot fly his airplane. I'll fly the right seat with him, and we'll get you back. So I wound up flying constantly, even though I had been in the wounded state. But it's things like that. And I got that stick from him whenever I left Vietnam. That's hanging on the wall back there. Uh-huh. But it was funny the way that some things work out that way.
Well, and that mission gave you your second Purple Heart out of three, if I'm reading the oak leaf clusters on your ribbon, right? Yeah. So there's another one we haven't heard about yet. But so it earned you a Purple Heart and the Silver Star.
That one got me the Silver Star. The one that got me the Distinguished Flying Cross was, there was a chopper that was shot down, and I landed under fire I have the pilots checked out to see if they could be rescued or whatever, but both of them were dead. I don't know what they didn't blow up the chopper after I gave them the report that the chopper was, you know, shot up, but the pilots were both dead in it.
But you risked your life to see if you could save theirs.
Right, and that gave me the DFC.
And I thought on one of the citations, there was an element of also redirecting aircraft fire that was going to kill some of your own troops, and you gave them a different location to hit the enemy.
That was part of the same mission. And yes, I overheard where they were going to hit, and I said, no, that's our troops in that area. Watch me, and I'll show you where to put your fire. So I low-leveled and dropped down and showed them, and then got my butt out of the way. And they went in and did some, that was all part of this same mission that I think saved a bunch of our ground troops.
Some pretty intense memories from 86-year-old John Hosey. He spent 29 years in our armed forces, and we're not done with his memories just yet. We've heard the stories behind two of his Purple Hearts, but there's one more to hear about, and if you visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll find photos that tell even more of that story. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. I always love hearing from listeners, and so many of you tell me you listen to Hometown Heroes while you're on the road. Nobody spends more more time on the road than our friends in the trucking business. And if that's your business, I'm sure you know about Central Valley Trailer Repair. If you don't, you really should. Conveniently located near California's major transportation arteries, CVTR has stockpiles of parts waiting for you in Fresno and in Stockton, with experienced service technicians ready to handle even the most difficult of repairs. Central Valley Trailer Repair is an authorized Great Dane sales, parts, and service center, and you can always find a huge inventory of new and used semi-trailers for sale too. Dry freight, refrigerated, flatbed, whatever you're looking for, CVTR has you covered. How about 24-hour emergency service? You bet. What can't CVTR help you with? That's a question I can't answer, so you'll have to ask them yourself at 1-800-877-8444. That's 1-800-877-8444. The website, that's simple, cvtr.com. For Central Valley Trailer Repair, and tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments, this is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and part two of our interview with 86-year-old John D. Hosey of Woodinville, Washington. Originally from Alabama, he served in the Korean War, the Vietnam War, and beyond. 29 years total, retiring as a lieutenant colonel. Some of his most intense experiences came as a helicopter pilot with the 282nd Aviation Company during the Vietnam War. You told us about some of the hairiest missions you had, but do you have a count of how many missions you flew over there?
Oh, jeepers. That's a good question. I don't know that I ever got a count of that. I've been asked how many hours that I've flown in combat, and I can only tell you that I don't know. I know that I flew almost every day, and once we reached 100 hours in a month, we were supposed to take 2 days off, and then we could fly again. That was our rule. I know that I cheated on those rules every now and then, so I guess if you said 12 times 100, that would give you pretty close to what I have flown. Or you could figure it out maybe another way. I got 25 air medals, so an air medal took 25 hours of combat, or 50 hours, I think it was, of flying in a combat zone. I'd say at least 95% of mine were probably under combat conditions, so that might give you a pretty good idea, too.
Well, another thing that a lot of people have counted, a lot of the World War II flyers and the fixed-wing stuff, will talk about a count of bullet holes in the aircraft, and I have to imagine you guys did that once or twice with your helicopter.
Yeah, the mission that I just told you about, my maintenance officer told me that he counted 187 holes throughout the chopper. Now, that was in and out, so who knows how many went through the door. But the strange part of it was that both pilots got hit, but neither one of my door gunners got touched. And we thanked the old man upstairs for their protection, because they protected us. That was another one. And the MACV team sent me a note telling me that they were grateful for what I did and everything, and that they were putting me in for an award. And I found out later that they had put their captain in for the DSC, and it had been downgraded to a Silver Star. So my group didn't even put me in. It was written up as a DSC, but they changed it when they heard he got the Silver Star. They changed mine to the Silver Star. But, Paul, I didn't do what I did for medals. I did what I did because, number one, it was a job that had to be done. When we came back from Vietnam, we were called baby killers. We were called, you know, all kinds of names. We were spit upon, and just you wondered why you did what you did at the time. But if we I know that politics got us out of Vietnam. If they had left us alone, maybe we would have given that country what we gave Korea, but they didn't. And political-wise, what just happened in Afghanistan is another thing that should have never happened. They should have gotten all of the civilians out of Afghanistan before they ever even mentioned that they were pulling the troops out, and then start pulling our troops out. And they wouldn't have had this mess that they had. The general that was in charge of that mission, he must have had his head up his butt, because he was not thinking, what's going to happen if I pull my troops out? And if you read the reports and everything, as we left one city, the Taliban moved right in and took that city within hours. And they were all prepared for our final pullout. So they had the upper hand all the way around.
Before I forget, I mean, I'm looking at your shadow box up here, and there's a medal from the Vietnamese government. There's the American Silver Star, the Bronze Star, the Distinguished Flying Cross. The Air Medal doesn't have room for all the clusters, because you mentioned 25 of those. Three Purple Hearts, and we've heard about two Purple Hearts. And that's not to mention the CIB, the Combat Infantry Badge, plus your paratrooper wings and your pilot's wings. That's a pretty crowded shadow box you got going there. But with the Purple Heart, we've heard about you being wounded in Korea, the bayonet through the arm. We heard about this mission. You're flying the helicopter. You're shot through the leg. Would have been shot higher on the leg if not for your camera in that spot, saving everybody's life aboard the chopper. What about the third Purple Heart?
Well, it was, I guess, the least of all, and I hardly ever mention it, but I took 13 stitches across my forehead from shrapnel. It was the metal off of the airplane from where one, bullet discharged that metal, and it put a strip across my forehead. And I think it was either 12 or 13 stitches. And the funny part there was the Marine that was sewing me up, after he cleaned it up and he started to sew me up, he was having trouble getting a needle through my thick skull up there. And after about the third stitch, I gritted my teeth and I said, "Damn, Captain, don't you have a duller needle you can use?" And he told me, he says, "Captain, you're lucky I've even got a needle to sew you up with." So after I got back on my feet and everything, I went to the hospital and got him a bunch of stuff and took him over and dropped it off at his hospital for him. They were all happy with that. But I wanted him to have at least some stitching needles. The one that looks like the fish hook?
Yeah.
That's the one. And I wanted him to have some of those for the next guy that he had to sew up.
Well, and, you know, the question comes to mind, too. So you said you rarely talk about it. It's no big deal. But a piece of shrapnel comes into your forehead. That's another one. I mean, that's a couple inches away from your eye. I mean, that could do a lot of damage to a lot of things. Could it killed you if it was placed right? What were the circumstances at the time? Where were you flying?
We were evacuating people out of Waysid. I must have had, I know I was overloaded. And I figured for landing, I would have a lot of my fuel gone, so I wouldn't, no sweat. But you could probably put two, three, four Vietnamese forever American on your chopper if you had the room for him. That was the difference in the weight and all. And coming out of Waysid, we lost our engine and took around, and we went into the South China Sea. I lost three people from drowning. I lost one Vietnamese kid. I lost one American who was a newspaper reporter. Then I lost one GI. The GI froze, and he wrapped his arms around the post in the helicopter, and that's where they found him. Mm. He was still had his arms wrapped around that post in the helicopter. He never let go so he could go to the surface and swim to shore, and that's where they found him. So he just froze right there. But he wasn't the only one that froze. When we started having troubles, my co-pilot, he froze whenever I told him to put out a mayday. And to wake him up, I had to slap him upside the head, and then he put out a mayday for us. But he turned out to be a great pilot overall. And all of us have our problems at times of freezing. It doesn't matter if you're driving a car or whatever you're doing. There's times when we freeze for a few seconds and we don't even realize it unless we get run off the road or run into a tree or something. Then we realize, hey, we could have avoided that, but we froze for a second. So you don't downgrade anybody, especially in combat. I have learned in combat conditions for freezing for a few seconds. Our biggest heroes have been, I don't really want to call them cowards to start, but they wound up being heroes. So you never know what you're capable of until you have to do it. And that was the thing. If you had told me that I would do what I did at 16 years old, I would have probably laughed at you and told you, hey, no way, I'm a bigger coward than that. You're not going to get me to do that. And then if after the Korean War, if you had told me what I'd be doing as a chopper pilot, I would have laughed at you again and said, you're crazy, man. So I don't laugh or downgrade anybody for doing some of the things that they do under combat conditions.
I've got a few more questions for you. I sure appreciate all your time and willingness to share, and I don't want to pry on that situation, but as I hear you describe that mission, I mean, you're nicked in the head, so you're bleeding. The aircraft is no longer cooperating. You're not going to make it to where you're going, and you ended up going into the water. And you told me about the three people who perished, but what about you? What did you have to do to survive once you hit the water?
You know, I honestly believe, Paul, it was the old man upstairs that, can you see that poster right there? See that Indian up above that soldier?
Yeah.
The artist gave me this. He said he couldn't sign it because if he signed it, I had to pay for it. So David gave it to me and he says, there is your angel. He says, you're part Cherokee. There is your angel. He will guard you and he'll take care of you. If you believe it. We had been trained only on blackboard, more or less, or through just talking, how to ditch a chopper in the water. You never turn a chopper to the left. You always try to turn it to the right once you're on the water. When I got close to the water, I did exactly what I had been taught because it all came back to me in my head. About 6 feet away from the water, I started to pull my collective and started slowing the chopper down. When I hit the water, I took and I turned it onto its right side. That takes the chopper blade into the water. On the left, the chopper blade comes into the helicopter. But if you turn it to the right, the chopper blade turns into the water, collapses on itself in the water. So I did exactly what I'd been taught. On the helicopters, there are a steel plate on the left and the right of the pilots. So if they're being shot at from the side, that plate deflects the bullet. The plate comes up just about like this and protects this. The only way that that plate can be moved is if the door gunner or the crew chief pulls the pin and slides it back, okay? When we hit the water, there was no way for our crew chiefs to do that. My guardian angel, I believe, all the way across the back and over the pilot's head is two rows of rivets in that helicopter. That helicopter split open like a can of sardines, and we went up through where the helicopter split open. And that's how we got out of that helicopter, both of us. That's how both pilots got saved. And I've got pictures of that. I don't know if you saw that in my book, but I got pictures of that, and I can show you. But we had about, 100, I'm going to say maybe 100 yards from the beach, because I'd turned back to the beach hoping to make it to the beach. We went in, and one Vietnamese kid died. I grabbed one Vietnamese boy and towed him to shore, and I couldn't do any more. But when we got to the shore, help started to arrive for us, and they started helping drag us out of the water and take care of who was hurt and that kind of stuff. So that one was just, I guess, overall freak of combat, too much time on the bird or something. But they got the bird out of the water, and they checked it out and all, and they came up with that the automatic fuel governor had cut out on me and died. The first time it just cut out, and then whenever I got the engine back, I put too much power back into it, and it cut out again, and that time I didn't ever got it back.
But aren't we thankful we got John Hosey back? I know his wife Sandy is. It's break time again, but we're not quite done yet. We'll get some final thoughts from this decorated veteran when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org. And you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. Let's try a little experiment here. I'm going to say a common three-word phrase, and I want you to pay attention to what kind of reaction it produces for you. You ready? Here we go. Buying a car. Okay, be honest, did you tense up a little? If so, I don't blame you. Buying a car can be really stressful, and I've got three more words for you to make sure you do get it right. You ready? Farney Automotive Group. We recently went looking for our daughter's first car, and I made a beeline for Selma because I knew my friends at Farney Ford, Farney Buick GMC, and Toyota of Selma were people I could trust. Trust is a very important word when it comes to buying a car. And here's my advice. Regardless of what kind of vehicle you're looking for, start your search at Toyota of Selma because you can check out their wall of honor with group photos from every single Central Valley Honor Flight. Over 1,300 veterans who have their pictures on the wall there and also got a free oversized group photo from their trip to D.C. thanks to the generosity of the Farney Automotive Group. So new or used, big or small, start your car search today at Toyota of Selma. You can't miss it on the west side of the 99 at the Floral Avenue exit. And don't leave without visiting that wall of honor.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler. Brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes as we wrap up a second episode with a decorated veteran of the wars in Korea and Vietnam by the name of John D. Hosey. Again, if you missed the first part of his story last week, you can pull up that episode and any of the 700-plus episodes of this program at hometownheroesradio.com.
So many of these stories are ones that I think a lot of people listening have never heard before and certainly haven't lived through ourselves, and I'm sure there's much more where that came from. And if there's anything else that's important to you to share, feel free, but I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us a story that nobody else could tell. And as I, you know, take stock of all this, you serve in the Korean War, in combat, in the Vietnam War, with everything you just talked about. You've also been a firefighter and in law enforcement, all the categories that we usually check the hero box for. You've lived all of those. I'm wondering, as you look back, what are the things that you're most proud of or most thankful for?
Well, there's a couple, Paul. One of them is my wife. I don't think that I could have done near what I have done in my life if I hadn't had a great companion by my side. And being married to her for 66 years and all that we've gone through, she had 5 miscarriages during our life. She went through, well, one time whenever I was wounded, she got notification She did not get the notification. My sister-in-law called her and says, have you heard? We just heard that J.D. got shot, that he got killed in a chopper fight in Vietnam. And I had told Sandy on a tape recording, do not believe anything that you hear unless you get it straight from the military, from the Army. So after Louise told her about that, she contacted the government, the Army, and they got back with her and said, no, he was wounded. He's okay. He's not dead. So that whoever told you that got the wrong information. Well, what they had gotten wrong was the aircraft that I had checked on. The pilot had been either 4 or 6 wounds across the chest, and that's where they connected me. And I had not been. To start with, I hadn't made major yet, and to start with, he was Major Hosey, but it wasn't Hosey. They got the. I did part of the mission, but I was not the one that was killed. She went through that. She went through all of the miscarriages except one without me. She stuck with me through thick and thin, and we've learned to really love and care one for another. We've got one boy that died with a brain tumor at 27. We've got a daughter down at Bonnie Lake that is a wonderful daughter. We got a son that works for Costco. He's been with them for 30-some-odd years. He's also a photographer. He photographs races, car races, and cars. He's photographed cars that I can't imagine paying $600,000 for or more, but, and then I've got a daughter that works for a cancer research here in Seattle, in Edmonds. I got a bunch of great grandkids, great grandkids, and I might even have some great grandkids out there. But she is one of my greatest achievements. And then another one is that I've had the opportunity to meet people that I never dreamed that I would ever meet. I've met 2 for sure, maybe even 3, counting Crandall, Medal of Honor recipients. I've lived a life that I think my dad and mom would have been proud of. I've always tried to respect other people, and I've always said that I'll respect you as long as you respect me. I don't give a crap who you are, what you are. As long as you do what's right, I'll be on your side. But as a deputy sheriff, I had to walk the talk in order to be and to tell you how to do it. And I'm proud of everything that I've done in my life. And having Chuck Kittles, the Medal of Honor recipient that I was closest to, because I served with him in France, I served with him in Texas, and I more or less served with him in Vietnam. I'm still in touch with part of his family. When he heard my wife had a stroke, he called me and he says, John, told me about a rail system that he had put into his house for his wife who was disabled. And he says, I'll send you a check right now for $2,500 to help you get started on it. That's the kind of friend he was. And having friends like that, I love it, and I appreciate him. And as long as I can look in the mirror, Paul, if I can look in that mirror and say, have you done the best you could do in everything you attempted to do all your life? As long as I can continue looking in that mirror and saying yes to that, I'm happy with me. And as long as I can, I left out one thing that maybe you should hear. When I retired from the Sheriff's Department, my grandson came up to me and he says, I volunteered you. And I said, what did you volunteer me for? Patrick says, Papa, I volunteered you to be our commander in the Sea Cadets, the U.S. Naval Sea Cadet Corps. And I said, do what? I said, son, I know nothing about the Navy. 13-year-old kid looked up at me and said, but Papa, you can learn. So I took over this outfit. It had 7 cadets in it. I told the parents, I said, I've been asked to take over this unit. Here's my way of handling your kids. And I said, I won't pull any punches with them. And I explained my way of handling it. I said, I'm going outside. I'm going to stand outside for a few minutes and wait on your decision. If you want me, send somebody out to get me. If you don't, I'm leaving in about 10 minutes. So I walked outside the building. I wasn't out there more than 5 minutes till my grandson came out and says, Papa, they're ready for you. So I went back in, and they said, we want you to be the commander. So I applied to be their commander. I went in front of the naval people who was going to approve or disapprove of me. They approved of me, and I wore my Army uniform, I think, for about 2 years. And finally, one of the Navy captains says, you've got to get out of that Army uniform and get into a Navy uniform. So I bought a naval uniform, and oh, I guess that picture's still up at the big house up there. But I started wearing a Navy uniform, and I went from 7 cadets to 37 cadets in 5 years. And 5 years, I got out of the Sea Cadets. So that's something that I was proud of. I taught those kids things that they would never get anywhere else. I took them down to Fort Lewis. I ran them through 2 weeks of summer camp with the special forces down there. And because I knew some of my nephew got killed in Afghanistan. He was part of the special forces down there. Oh, one thing you might be interested in, Paul. One of my flights, we were flying and surveying, and I saw a guy running through the jungle in the black pajama type stuff. And my guys found him, and we started to shoot him. And I'm sure you've heard the name Nick Rowe, or have you? Mm-hmm. Okay, Nick Rowe. We picked him up. We almost shot him, but we picked him up and got him out. And later on at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, I flew him off and on to talk about escape and evasion courses. So that was, and then sadly enough, he was signed to the Philippines, and they got him in the back alley and beat him to death. And he died as a full-bird colonel. But that's a sad tale there. Another one was that we were doing the same thing, and one of my gunners says, sir, I think I just saw a deer. I said, you're kidding me. So we circled back, and he had seen a deer. Pretty big deer for a deer. I mean, it looked more like an elk than it did a deer. Wow. They said, let's kill him and take him back to camp. You know, China Beach is our Da Nang. And I said, what do you want us to do, get court-martialed? No, but hey, how long's it been since you had deer meat? And I said, quite a while. Well, we circled. We shot the deer. I landed, dropped off one of my crew chief to harness him all up and everything. Got back up in the air, and he waved that he was ready. We went down, picked him up, picked up the deer, and took it back to the camp. And Major Ward... My 06. What was in your mind whenever you did that? Do you realize you was compromising your whole ship and everything, and you was on the ground and all? What do you think you was doing? And I said, well, I thought I was getting us some food. And after he got through chewing me out, I saluted him in this. I walked out his door. He says, thanks, John, for the deer meat. So we barbecued on China Beach area out there. China Beach was on TV for a while. Okay, that's where we barbecued, and we had deer barbecue and a wonderful meal. So those are some of the good times that we had over there. Thank you, Paul, for giving me the opportunity to express myself, and all I want to do is thank any and all of our military people for everything that they've done for this country. And if you are a Korean veteran out there, feel free to contact me, and I'll give you a phone number of Susan Key, who is the Korean ambassador for the military, and not for her country, but for us. And she's a great lady, and she can help you get in touch with the Korean people. And the Korean people are really happy with what we did to save their country. But I want to repeat again that, Paul, I've always tried to tell, I know that we got a lot of military people out there that's got problems. They got, I'll call it mindset problems. If they've got problems, find someone who has been through the same area, same problem, same everything that you've been through or close to it. Sit down, talk to these people. Talk out what's in your heart. I've had times that I didn't want to talk about these things. But whenever I was asked to speak at high schools and I started speaking, my heart was opened. And I can tell you right now that I'm not ashamed or afraid of anything that I've ever done. I did it under orders, and I did it because I was there to do it. I did not volunteer to go out and try to shoot anybody or anything. But I did volunteer to try to save a lot of lives, and I've done my best at that. And my heroes are the ones that did not come back. Yeah, I've got a lot of hero medals. I got 4 of the top 6, but I'm not a hero. A lot of people call me a hero. But Paul, I did a job that I was sent out to do. And if push comes to shove, I would do it today.
I don't think anybody who has listened to John D. Hosey's story would doubt that one bit. If you have a few minutes to visit hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page, you'll also find a short video with Mr. Hosey describing that rescue mission that earned him the Silver Star. And I'll tell you, it never gets old. Every time, no matter where I get to go in this beautiful country of ours, the veterans I have the privilege of meeting always amaze and inspire. Thanks again to Mr. Hosey and his lovely wife, Sandy, for letting us into their world. And thank you for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.